Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of pre-recorded musings on science, technology, drug therapy, and more. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Every now and then, I get so many interesting articles that I need to just take a moment, step back, and try to pull it all together in a way that'll make sense and help you understand some of the very exciting and deep understanding that we're finally getting about, in this case, the genome, epigenetics, and its effect on how we live our lives. In fact, its effect on just about everything. How much salt we like, how we experience pain, how our memories work, and oh well. Stay tuned and keep listening to Ask Dr. Dawn. To my podcast audience, I want to emphasize that donations to KUSP at KUSP.org are much approved and much requested. So since we're doing a science show, let's start out with, I think, what may be one of the more exciting stories of 2010. This is work being done right now at Carnegie Mellon University. The researcher to search on is Marcel Just, J-U-S-T. He's a psychology professor at the Center for Cognitive Brain Imaging at Carnegie Mellon. Dr. Just has been working on learning how to read minds, or at least learning how to see how words are understood in the brain. It's very interesting research. They took 11 right-handed volunteers and put them into a functional MRI machine, which uses labeled glucose to see where in the brain metabolism has speeded up because the neurons are firing. They had them read a list of commonplace nouns 6 times in various random order, taking a moment to think about each word. So the researchers documented exactly what lit up in that individual's brain, real time, as they thought about words. Now, these were all common nouns for commonplace things, building parts like door, window, chimney, body parts like arm and leg, different types of tools, vehicles, vegetables, pieces of clothing, things like that. Now, this type of research answers 2 questions, one of which is, how are words codified in the brain? Is it a single location or is it distributed, as most current thinking would suggest? And what is the level of similarity or overlap the way different individuals' brains might conceptualize a word? This goes back to an issue that's been playing in the top 40 in philosophy class for the last couple of hundred years, which is, if I see the color blue, how do we know that I'm experiencing blue the same way you are? Could my blue be your red, for example? Is the representation between different human brains the same or different? Well, not to beat around the bush, there is a fair amount of overlap. Now, what the researchers found was that there are 4 dominant patterns of brain activation, depending upon what the person was thinking about. So, for example, nouns tended to distribute into 1 of 4 groups, and each of these had a distinct brain activation pattern. Things that were manipulated was one group, things that can be eaten, a second group, things that represent shelter or an entryway, and finally, words that are long. Not too surprisingly, the parts of the brain that might conceivably correspond to the actual use, real time, in reality, of the things these nouns symbolized, lit up in appropriate patterns. In other words, when a word that was something that could be manipulated was thought about, the part of the brain that controlled the motor activity of grasping or moving the hand and arm lit up. When thinking about shelter, areas that have previously been associated with recognizing and identifying buildings lit up. Eating, interestingly enough, activated the part of brain associated with movement of the lower facial muscles, lips and tongue. That reminds me of my dog Spooky, whose way of telling me that she wants a snack is to stick her tongue out and lick her lips. So, using this information in just 11 subjects, the researchers were able to tell whether a particular brain was thinking about an arm or an airplane or a telephone or a pair of pants. And they were able to see this across all 11 subjects. Now, this is a long way from a device that's going to be able to read your mind, but it's a good proof of concept. And when you couple this with what we know about being able to induce increased activity in brain cells by the application of strong magnets on the scalp, it seems to me that we're not too far from being able to change the bias on the way people think, potentially opening up new pathways for the treatment of depression and diseases of impulse control, such as ADHD. Personally, I'd rather wear a beret with a magnet over a part of my skull than take a pharmaceutical that's going to affect every cell in my body. How about you? For this last commentary, I do need to credit Melissa Healy, who wrote this article from the Los Angeles Times, from which I drew this information. A couple of interesting stories from, of all things, this month's Popular Science. The first one, the announcement of the first artificial lung. Now, of course, this was done in rats, but this concept of regenerative medicine using biological or manufactured scaffolding and then seeding with stem cells, feeding them the appropriate stimulatory signals and then standing back and letting them build an organ is really starting to take hold. The key issue here turns out to be some kind of framework or scaffolding that provides the stem cells with a blueprint to grow upon. This latest research on lung took place at Yale University in the lab of Laura Nicholson. The researchers took out a rat's lungs and stripped away all of the cells, leaving just the collagen scaffolding. Then they took adult stem cells harvested from other rats and seeded the scaffolding. These stem cells first grew along the trachea and the bronchioles and then multiplied to fill that tubing with respiratory epithelium. This first bit was accomplished by epithelial stem cells. Then the researchers collected endothelial stem cells from other rat lungs and instilled these into this newly created structural lung. The endothelial cells knew just what to do and turned into blood vessels and capillaries surrounding the newly formed alveoli and bronchioles such that oxygen could then be inhaled and transmitted across these cell walls. They then transplanted the created lung back into other rats, where they worked about 95% as well as a regular lung. This is really a proof of concept more than something we can anticipate will replace lung transplants anytime soon. For one thing, the researchers do have a problem with rejection, although that might be accomplished by using cells from undifferentiated neonatal stem cells, perhaps harvested from either cord blood or even amniotic fluid. We'll be talking more about epigenetics over the course of the rest of this program, and I think you'll see that there is definitely a place for manipulating the stem cells from wherever they come in order to make them less antigenic. Still, this is very promising, and it definitely beats the old science fiction model of growing a body clone so you can harvest its spare parts. Once upon a time, there was the Human Genome Project, and we really thought that if we could decode the entire human genome, that we would be able to find the genetic basis for many common diseases. Unfortunately, one of the rules of science is that the deeper you dig, the more complexity you find. Early genetic research, using fragments of the information and attempting to match DNA to disease based on the idea that common mutations would in fact reflect common diseases, has turned out not to be the case. There's hope that when it gets cheap enough to provide an entire genome. That whole genome research will allow us to tease out some of this information and perhaps lead to drugs or therapies for common diseases. But it wouldn't surprise me a bit if, in fact, once we peel off that layer and do that research, that yet more work remains to be done. And that's because having the gene just means it's present. But whether that gene is turned on or turned off determines whether you exhibit the disease. And in fact, genes turn on and turn off all the time through the mechanisms now referred to as epigenetics. There are two main ways that genes are turned on and off. One of them is called methylation. And in methylation, little carbon-hydrogen groups are attached to the DNA. They can either act to turn on or to turn off a sequence, making it possible for it to be transcribed and many, many copies made, or the opposite, making it such that that DNA is locked and cannot be read by the cell, except in the case of back mutation, removing that methylation block. Let's do a little primer on DNA before we launch into this discussion of genetics and epigenetics. For those of you to whom this is a review, I apologize. In each human cell, there is a sequence of genetic information called DNA. The total length of the DNA, if we were to stretch it out, is about 6 feet. And it's divided up into two sets of 23 more or less identical chromosomes. There are only four letters in the DNA alphabet: A, G, C, and T. And when everything is completely correct, across from every A is a T, and across from every G is a C. This allows the DNA to zip apart, just like the teeth on a zipper, be replicated, and zip back together again. While the zipper is open, a copy of a portion of the sequence of DNA is made into a slightly different molecule called messenger RNA. It's different enough from DNA to be identified chemically, but it contains the same complexity of information. The messenger RNA leaves the nucleus and goes to the endoplasmic reticulum, where ribosomes clamp onto it and transcribe the sequence into proteins. The proteins either fold up and become enzymes or provide structure for the body. That's the basic process. Epigenetics is anything that influences the transcription of the messenger RNA. Not all of the DNA actually codes for protein. A lot of it, it turns out, codes for control buttons or levers, if you will, that can be pushed by hormones like estrogen or carrier proteins or a variety of other compounds, including some environmental pollutants. A gene that is upregulated by methylation might unzip very readily, allowing many copies of messenger RNA to occur. In fact, additional, normally silent copies of the gene may be opened up by excessive methylation. This occurs in cancer cells. On the other hand, methylation can also silence a gene, effectively making it stuck so that it can't be unzipped and transcribed into messenger RNA. The B vitamins, especially B12 and folate, and sulfur-containing vegetables, such as broccoli, have a great deal to do with maintaining the methylation of DNA. Remember, as new copies are made, they have to be remethylated. And should methyl levels fall short, there's the possibility of a chance for a cancer gene to be turned on. The other common means of epigenetic modification is called histone modification. Histones are like little spools that the DNA wraps around, kind of like curlers, well, in terms of their basic shape. And DNA that's wrapped around a histone isn't available to be read or transcribed. Modifying the histone is how you allow bits to be read and used. Another article in this month's Popular Science speaks to this second mechanism, histone modification. Published in the May issue of Science, researcher Andre Fisher and others working on memory have found something very, very interesting in the brains of mice who have been genetically modified to act like Alzheimer's patients. First of all, what is going on with memory? Neuroscience knows that much of memory is dependent upon functioning in the hippocampus, a structure deep in the brain near the pituitary gland. In order for a short-term memory to become encoded and reside long-term in the brain, genetic production of messenger RNA is required. In other words, neurotransmitters have to be manufactured, and these help trigger the connections, the dendrites that link the two neurons, and it is in this physical structure of new dendrites that we believe memory is effectively stored. Now, there's a particular histone called histone type 4, and this is extremely important in unrolling DNA and in recording memories. This histone type 4 responds to attachment by an acetyl group, similar to a methyl group in that it's also formed of carbon and hydrogen. This acetyl group, once attached to the histone, allows it to unwind slightly, freeing up some DNA for transcription. If you've got it wrapped up just right, and those are the neurotransmitters that trigger memory, well, you can sort of see how that would work. In age-related memory loss in these Alzheimer's mice, the H4 histones have markedly fewer acetyl groups attached on them. That means the neurotransmitter DNA is bound more tightly and cannot unlock and allow for the new synapses to form. Now, this is all very well and good, but how does it help? Well, the researchers showed that a type of enzyme called a histone deacetylase inhibitor, and if you parse that out, it's something that inhibits the removal of acetyl groups from histones, when given to mice with age-related memory defects, reversed about 50% of the memory loss. Of course, before we start putting this into development for drug therapy, I would suggest it would be a good idea to find out what else we're turning on when we re-acetylate a histone protein. Nevertheless, for people with significant cognitive defects who don't have really long enough to live to develop a serious cancer, let's say a lifespan less than 10 years, actuarially speaking, this might be a good trade-off. I certainly myself think that I would value quality over duration when it comes my time to have to make that decision. So I'm sure there are other people who would be willing to test a new drug based on this concept. And so let's move on to other research aimed essentially at manipulating epigenetics, turning on and off genes. One of the things that makes epigenetics so fascinating is the fact that it can occur so quickly. Even sometimes a single event may alter the epigenetics of a cell. And if that happens to a germ cell, that is to say a sperm or an ova, that can have generational implications. We also have evidence that the diet and personal circumstances of the mother, for example, whether she's under a lot of stress, may affect the epigenetics of a wide number of body cells of the growing fetus, leading, among other things, to an increased predilection for diabetes in the children and also the grandchildren of women who were stressed by starvation or near starvation during pregnancy. The idea, sometimes known in scientific circles by the shorthand of Lamarckian evolution, that giraffes got long necks by stretching to reach the tall trees, may not be so far-fetched. In fact, our culture and our society and our diet may be causing epigenetic changes in our cells every single moment. In fact, some researchers say that epigenetic change is the dominant factor in human evolution. Researchers Dr. Robert Boyd and Peter J. Richardson argue that culture is a selective force for genetics. They cite, as an example, lactose intolerance. Most people in the world, having obtained adult age, stop being able to digest milk products. But people who have Northern European ancestry do not. This is probably because about the time that the group of people that settled down and began raising cows and crops, who later became what we think of as Northern European races, were a cattle-rearing culture. It was very important to them to continue to use milk and cheese in their diet. The concept is that Being able to absorb all of that abundant extra nutrition was a selective advantage in adulthood. And so the normal process of epigenetically silencing the lactose digesting enzyme gene didn't happen as it normally did. So let's just clarify this. Under normal circumstances, the genes that are turned on while we're in the uterus are genes that are necessary then. But should those genes turn on later in life, they can contribute to cancer. Likewise, as part of the natural progression from childhood to adulthood, certain genes are silenced. In the case of lactose tolerance, the silencing of the lactase gene never occurs. We also see similar genetic switches in pastoral cultures in Africa, such as the Maasai. Researchers studying the human genome estimate that about 10% of the genome shows signs of being under selective pressure of some sort. This is fascinating research, but it's extremely complicated. And one of the problems in trying to infer what might be the selected for trait is that many genes do more than one thing. A good example is a gene called EDAR. It's known to be involved in controlling the growth of hair. And in fact, there's a variant form of this, very common in East Asians and Native Americans, that causes the hair to be thicker and longer. So there's several possibilities for why this could have been a selected for gene. For example, it might be because these groups originated in Siberia and it was colder and they needed extra hair for warmth. Or it could have been an accident, a cultural bias towards long, thick hair which led to sexual selection, a kind of tonsorial survival of the fittest. But the third possibility is even more intriguing, because it turns out that this gene doesn't just regulate the growth of hair. It also regulates certain factors very important in the immune system. So it may have been selected for because it conferred disease resistance. So as we talk about epigenetics, remember that there are lots of devils in these details. Research at this time tends to be biased towards finding cures and treatments, particularly patentable treatments, for disease. This may lead to rapid pressure to bring to market drugs which selectively eliminate methylation or acetylation or otherwise turn on promoter regions with a good intention, but possibly with an adverse, unintended consequence. From a research standpoint, humans have annoyingly long lifespans. So humans doing research on humans is always a problem. As a result, much of the work that we will be talking about has been done on other mammals, such as mice or rats. In a recent study this year published in the journal Hypertension, Dr. Jennifer Pollack, a biochemist at the Vascular Biology Center in the Medical College of Georgia, did interesting work on epigenetics and stress. This work was done on rat pups and subjected them to the stress of separation from their mother. It was part of a longitudinal study looking to see whether stress created hypertension. Now, at first glance, the study was unsuccessful. After separating the rats from their mothers for 3 hours daily for 2 weeks, they showed no long-term impact on key indicators of cardiovascular disease like increased blood pressure, heart rate, or inflammation in the blood vessel walls. But when these animals reached adulthood, they were exquisitely responsive to an infusion of the hormone angiotensin II. Angiotensin II is a signaling hormone. It rises naturally with age and stress, and it is deeply implicated in hypertension. In fact, two of the most commonly used groups of drugs for hypertension in humans, the angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors and the angiotensin receptor blockers, are obviously making sure that that signal doesn't get where it's supposed to go. Now, I want to emphasize that this study has not located the actual place on the rat, or for that matter, the human genome, where this change in the signaling capacity for angiotensin is taking place. But there is good epidemiological data that something of this kind does occur in humans. In a paper published in the journal Circulation in 2004, there was a strong correlation between adverse childhood events, such as child abuse or loss of a parent, with later development of cardiovascular disease in adulthood. Other research, as much as 10 years old, shows that childhood stress or trauma has a strong association with the development of depression later in life, but only in people who possess a certain gene. In other words, if you have a strong family history of depression, your probability of severe depression as an adult is made worse by your DNA, but then even worse if you have a particular genetic inheritance from your parents. The epigenetic signals are cumulative and subtle. They don't necessarily turn on or off genes, but they affect the thresholds for genes to be turned on and off. It's turning out to be a far more nuanced situation than we could possibly have suspected 10 years ago. And the environment keeps changing. We've talked before in this program about bisphenol A, a non-steroidal estrogen-type molecule that's found in certain types of plastic, the linings of tin cans, and, unfortunately, in the bloodstreams and fat of all modern Americans. Recently published in the online journal FASCB, work by Jason Bromer et al. Actually got down to the nuts and bolts level to look at the mechanism for some of the changes that we've seen. It has been suggested that bisphenol A may be responsible for some of the changes that we've seen in the last couple of decades, earlier puberty and earlier breast development in females and decline of fertility in males are both well-documented epidemiological findings. The cause, not so clear. In Dr. Bromer's work, pregnant mice were treated with a high dose of BPA on day 9 through 16 of pregnancy. They found what appeared to be an epigenetic mechanism. In the treated mice, there was about 25% less methylation in a particular location on the DNA. Because of decreased methylation, there was increased estrogen binding to that DNA and an increase in estrogen-driven gene expression. At least in the mice, this effect appeared to be permanent, effectively increasing the amount of genetic product that would be stimulated by estrogen. Now, because estrogen is very important in all sorts of genetic regulation, this could have a profound crescendo effect. Now, I do want to emphasize this was mice and they were using high doses. So it's a proof of concept study, not necessarily a proof of effect. However, as it gets cheaper and cheaper to do genome studies, it will be possible to go back and take DNA from children with precocious puberty, for example, or women with breast cancer, or men with prostate cancer, and look at the percentage DNA methylation they have at these sites compared to that of the general population. Because we're dealing with something here, methylation or non-methylation, that is less technique and laboratory dependent, I think it will be possible to pool data from around the world to answer these important questions. But don't lose heart, because epigenetics cuts both ways, and what happened in childhood can be undone by what happens in adulthood. I want to tell you about a study done in 2008 by Dean Ornish, who is well known as a promoter of a healthful diet as a way to prevent cardiovascular disease. Dr. Ornish is a professor of medicine at UCSF, and I had the good fortune to meet him at the recent Institute for Functional Medicine's Cancer as a Chronic Disease conference, where he was one of the speakers. The study looked at men with prostate cancer who had elected not to get chemotherapy. The men were placed on a low-fat diet based primarily on soy protein, fruits, vegetables, and beans, and were asked to exercise 30 minutes a day, do yoga or meditate for 1 hour a day, and boost their social support network. All fairly sensible bits of good health advice. What is especially interesting about this study, however, is that they tracked over 500 genes that are known as oncogenes by looking at their genetic products. And what they found was that the activity of all of these oncogenes was reduced by methylation changes which occurred in the subject group. Among other things, these genes are known to spur oxidative stress and inflammation, as well as being associated with both prostate and breast cancer. Just the act of exercising has been shown to epigenetically modify the DNA for neuroepithelial growth factor, a gene that helps your nerve cells remain strong and produce new memories. In fact, studies looking at memory function have shown that as little as half an hour of exercise a day does seem to improve memory function, and levels of neuroepithelial growth factor do increase. That's still just associational. We can't prove cause and effect, but it's awfully darn persuasive. The implications for cancer are staggering. It may be that it's not so much that genes are mutated by a rupture in the DNA sequence, but instead that the muffling that should occur with development gets undone and genes get turned back on again as they had been in utero. Whether that means taking a methylation group away or adding one back on is part of the devilish details involved in this research. There is actually a drug called Vidaza, V-I-D-A-Z-A, which works by removing the DNA methylation on certain genes that are normally protective against tumor development. The question, of course, is what other areas are being affected and demethylated that we don't know about, and can such a drug be truly targeted? While we're wandering around in the genome and talking about messenger RNA being transcribed or not transcribed, I thought it would be a perfect time to talk a little bit about small interfering RNAs. Now, these don't really occur in nature, but it's a very elegant way of changing the way that genes that have been epigenetically turned on can be blocked without actually going into the nucleus and messing with the DNA itself. Small interfering RNAs are actually antisense strands of messenger RNA. In other words, remember that the messenger RNA is like a fragment of that DNA zipper. Well, if you have a little fragment of the corresponding zipper that grabs that messenger RNA, then it cannot be read by the ribosome, and therefore no protein is produced in the endoplasmic reticulum. It's tricky to do, and the circumstances where it can be done where one is sure that one doesn't do some sort of other damage are thin on the ground. But here's an example of one of them. First, the setup. When a person develops lymphoma, they're often treated with intense chemotherapy and then a stem cell transplant. In the case of patients who have lymphoma because of HIV, using altered stem cells provides an opportunity to test whether or not genes can be implanted into these individuals that would allow them to resist HIV infection of their white blood cells. The researchers created stem cells that were modified to contain DNA that would lead to the production of small interfering mRNAs to a couple of genes that were vital to HIV. One of these genes, the CCR5 protein, is a gene that we can live without. In fact, a large number of people with HIV who are referred to as chronic non-progressors don't progress in their HIV because they lack this protein, which sits on the surface of cells and is a kind of a docking protein for the HIV virus. A cell that does not produce this protein on its surface cannot be infected by HIV. So, including in the stem cells a gene for messenger RNA that zips up the messenger RNA that would otherwise be transcribed to form CCR5, is a very elegant way of blocking the cell from being infected by HIV. They use two other genes. One of them, a short piece of RNA that actually comes from the HIV virus. So the small interfering messenger RNA here was actually messenger RNA to block the RNA that is being made by the retrovirus itself. The third gene made anti or small interfering messenger RNA against one of HIV virus's chief regulatory proteins. Now, obviously, doing a bone marrow transplant as a treatment for HIV is disproportionate. However, should embryonic stem cell therapy allow us to produce stem cells that do not contain any antigenic markers and would therefore not be attacked by the person's own immune system, it might be possible to not just treat HIV as we currently do, but actually modify the blood of HIV patients permanently such that their white count never falls to dangerous levels. I'm interested to see how this technology develops. Having an off switch that doesn't involve actually messing with the DNA seems to me to be a very useful technology to pursue. It used to be not such a big deal. You went to the doctor's office, you paid $5 or $10, and that was your copay. No big deal. Wasn't really a deterrent. Now, fast forward 10 years, and copays are getting up to $25, $35, sometimes even $50. That's a lot of money. How much money do you think you've saved in copays over the last couple of years of listening to this program? Did I keep you from having to go to the doctor once, twice, more? Well, I'll make you a deal. Let's split the difference. Take that copay and send me half, care of KUSP. And in order to do that, you can simply go to KUSP.org and pledge now. This is Dr. Dawn for now saying so long and stay healthy.